So, good evening. It's a pleasure to be here in this very significant place. It's an honor to be speaking at the Freud Museum. And thank you, Bonnie, for inviting me to do this. So what I'm going to do is basically explain those four terms. I thought that would be the best, more accessible way to talk about the seminar. So if it sparks your interest, then you can read more in the book. So first, the concept of la langue. So in the session of the 18th of November of 1975, Lacan calls the French language his la langue. La langue refers to the language of the unconscious based on homophony, for those who don't know, words that sound the same, and to alliterations of language, for example, not naughty, meaning spelled K-N-O-T-T-Y, or you could say, which also rhymes with naughty, in terms of being naughty, not naughty, or a big bully beats a baby boy. That would be another example of alliteration, which doesn't depend on letters, but on the sounds of the letters. And obliterations of language, these are just some literary devices that I'm using, for example, as an example, which is to remove or destroy all traces, to blot out or render indecipherable, or to efface. You can see the resonance with Freud there. And these alliterations and obliterations of language turn around, according to Lacan, circle around the object A, which is, as you know, Lacan's term for Freud's unconscious part object, as a reference to Freud's unconscious equation and to an elaboration of Freud's unconscious equation, as the object of the drive and the object cause of desire. So la langue, Lacan says, is the language of the one in contrast to language, which is the language of the other. And how the real, what Lacan calls the real, and of course the real, I'm elaborating a little bit because we're here in Freud's home, is where Freud talked about the, of course he makes a different use, but we find that reference in Freud in terms of the unconscious in the sense of the unknown or the unknowable. And this real appears within language, for example, in la langue, and not only in mathematical formalization or jouissance. I will define jouissance. But the real, Lacan talks in terms of mathematical formalization, jouissance, and la langue. La langue is associated with the mother, with desire, the mother's desire, and the language of desire. In seminar three, Lacan's seminar number three on psychosis, he made a fundamental distinction between unconscious language as it appears in delusion and so-called normal language, which was the beginning of a differentiation between la langue and language. Lacan's own name can be used as an example of la langue. For example, we could say Jacques Lacan, lacking Jack, empty Jack, a subject without a substance. Because the subject supposed to know, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of the subject supposed to know, which is the way that Lacan elaborated the notion of transference in relationship to knowledge, is a sujet sans substance, ultimately, a subject without a substance, which in this case is much more than the signifier itself, since the name, as la langue, points to a fact of the real structure of the subject. La langue is both S1, or a signifier, and not the S1 that is linked to S2, meaning a battery of signifiers. meaning that in the symbolic, you have one word, you go to the dictionary, it refers you to other words. And there's a battery of signifiers and a dynamic and a displacement within language, which is the language of the other. So this lalang is an S1 that is not linked to S2. In other words, lalang is S1 or a signifier, which we could say equals S0, or the senseless, or without meaning, or outside the S2 of language. S2 redefines S1 and turns S1 into S2, or lalang into language, the signifier into the signified as another signifier. Meaning, the meaning of a signifier is given by another signifier, just like I said in the reference to the dictionary. Yet the signified, or the meaning of the signifier, has two meanings. It can either mean another signifier, which establishes a relationship of meaning and signification, meaning being imaginary, signification being symbolic, or it can mean the use of the signifier to represent what Lacan calls significance. I translate it as significance, Fink, which is a known translator of Lacan, translated as signifierness, which represents sounds, the voice as an object A, independently of what you say. There's the actual quality of the voice as a sound, and that's an object A for Lacan. It represents also enigmas, and ultimately also enigmatic affects, feelings that are enigmatic. So this is the signified in the real, where meaning lies in the real, or meaning could lie in the imaginary, or it could lie in the symbolic. So meaning, signification, significance. So that's lalang. Symptom. A similar equivocation arises between language and lalang, as between symptom and symptom. Both terms, sometimes Lacan uses them as similar and duplicate, and sometimes as different. And that's what makes Lacan's text confusing sometimes, because you don't know which one he's talking about at which time, whether he's talking about symptom or whether he's talking about symptom. This is an example of the division of one into two apparently identical terms that differentiate, S1 and S2. S1 stands for lalang and for symptom, while S2 stands for language and the symptom. S1 without S2 is undefinable and ambiguous. At the same time, once defined by S2, meaning once the meaning of a word is given by another word, there's something of the first word that remains outside the categories of the second word. Meaning, in the translation from one signifier to another signifier, there's an aspect of the meaning of the first signifier that lies in the real that gets lost in the translation to the symbolic. The act of speech, because there's speech, content of speech, there's voice, and then there's actual act of speech. The act of speech and the sound of speech remain behind language, or the content of speech, and what the other hears or understands, although the act and the sound is also heard. So we hear not only the statements, but we also hear the sound and the voice. And the sound and the voice have an impact on the body. Of the receiver. So lalang is associated with the voice and phonation, and the phonem as an objecta, because Lacan will also say that the phonem is an objecta. And both say more than the word or the statement. Say more than the word or the statement. The relationship between S1 and S2 also points to how Lacan's theory has an undefinable or incomprehensible element that can't be reduced to any theoretical system. It is fine and necessary to have a coherent theory to combine a series of concepts so long as the theory retains an element or dimension that escapes the closure or saturation of the theory. Because the theory tends to close upon itself. So you have to build in, we were talking about a placeholder for this undefinable element so that the theory doesn't collapse onto itself and can continue to grow and develop. This would be true for both language and mathematics, following up Kurt Gödel's theory of incompleteness. The incompleteness theorem showed us that the one unifying theory of everything that was promised by mathematics could never be discovered. Lacan says that the French la langue became something different with the injection of Greek into French, and the word symptôme was rendered as symptom. So Lacan goes back and names the symptom once again as symptom or symptôme. In Lacan, la langue and symptôme fall into the place of the S1, S0, or the real unconscious, while language and symptom occupy the place of S1, S2, the more usual acceptation of the Freudian unconscious. So the real unconscious is a concept of Lacan, and I'll say more about it. So the symptom also comes in two forms. In contradistinction to the psychotic symptom, for example, the symptom and the real name of the father appear as a supplement and an addition. Because in analysis, the place of the father has to move from the symbolic eventually to the real. Because otherwise, the father and language and the other appears an imposition on the subject. So this movement of the name of the father to the real seems to be, for Lacan, seem especially important in the treatment of psychosis. But it's also a vicissitude of the analysis of neurosis as well. The symptom, so, is this different from what Freud called the restitutive function of a symptom? In psychosis, for example, Freud said that the main symptom of the disorder was a thought disorder, or the loosening of associations, or what keep the associations together. But that's the first moment of the illness. Then in the second moment, a delusion is constructed to repair this damage in the link between associations, between ideas. So Freud thought that delusions were an attempt, an organic attempt at healing the psychosis. However unsuccessful that attempt may be, because the attempt itself becomes part of the disorder. So for Lacan, the symptom in a psychotic structure has a preventative and reparative function installed at the place where he says the topological knot of three failed for the subject. So the topological knot of three is Lacan's way of talking. You know, we have the three registers, and with the symptom he invents a fourth ring or fourth register that relinks. The links that were there before have to be undone. In psychosis, they're already undone because one of the imaginary is loosened from the other two dimensions. There's a lot to say about the topological knot of three, but it, in so many ways, it does refer to Freud's interest in the two theories of mind. You have three elements. You have the conscious, preconscious, the unconscious, and then you have it, ego, and superego. In the case of Joyce, and I assume there's a lot that needs to be unpacked there, because Lacan was interested in topology. and describing the structure of the psyche through topological images. And this is part of the knot of three and the knot of four. In the case of James Joyce, according to Lacan, the symptom exemplified by his writing was installed to prevent the precipitation of a psychotic disorder within what Lacan considered to be a psychotic structure. There's a whole debate about whether Joyce really had, from a clinical point of view, had a psychotic structure or not, but Lacan goes with that assumption. In the case of a psychotic disorder, the symptom as a fourth element can be used to treat the symptoms of psychosis. The symptom includes the illness, but the cure is not a part of the illness, although the illness also contributes to its own cure. And the analyst or the clinician is just using that organic attempt within the psyche itself to give it an extra prod or direction. Lacan also uses the name of the father coming from the real as opposed to the symbolic, because in the symbolic, the name of the father was seen as a key element organizer of the symbolic order. Whereas in with the name coming from the real, there's a different organization that comes to fruition. But let me there's a lot more to say about that, but I don't have enough time. But Lacan also uses this name of the father coming from the real, or the symptom, because he uses those terms alternatively. Symptom and name of the father coming from the real. He also used this concept to represent the end of analysis for a neurotic. Lacan spoke of the identification with the symptom instead of with the ego of the analyst, as in ego psychology, or the good object, as in object relations, as what marks the end of an analysis. An analysis gradually unfolds as a series of complaints leveled against the other, and eventually at the analyst in the transference. The other is blamed for the symptom. The analysis may be set to end when the symptom is no longer blamed on the other, and the subject can take responsibility for his or her symptom. The analysis becomes a disciple of the symptom, and this is what contributes to the after effects of analysis, meaning that the analysis still continues to produce effects after termination through the symptom and the subject's new relationship to their symptom. At this point, the symptom becomes a symptom that the subject can identify as his or her own production. This is a simple way to link the concept of identification with the symptom that differs from the identification with the symptom. Jouissance. In his lecture at the Catholic University of Louvain in the 1970s, Lacan asked his audience, because that was his style, he would say, "Can any of you bear the life that you have?" So from this statement, we could say that jouissance points to the impossible experience of bearing the unbearable. In this sense, jouissance is intrinsically related to suffering and not just to pleasure or enjoyment or even sexuality, as the word commonly refers to in the French language. This conception of jouissance highlights the connection between jouissance and the death drive. In addition, the death drive is not without connections to sexuality, since Freud, in 1920, also made a distinction between eros and sexuality, one that we're not too familiar with, but it's there. Eros creates bonds and larger unities, where sexuality can destroy the same. On the other hand, Freud's theory is paradoxical enough that the death drive, working through the symbolic, and the symbolic here would be defenses or the Nirvana principle, as Freud defined it in the pleasure, beyond the pleasure principle, and the real, can also generate links, and sexuality as eros rather than as death drive can also do the same. So sexuality can destroy links between people or can create links between people, as we all know from ordinary life. It is this paradoxical aspect of the drives and of pain and pleasure that is at the core of the definition of jouissance. Jouissance seeks satisfaction, and in the process it can become suffering and pain. When the drive spills over and overruns the defenses and barriers that are also generated by the pleasure principle in an attempt to lower or avoid pain. So that's an element of Freud's theory that we often is easy to miss, that the pleasure principle, not only as Freud defined it first as an attempt at a hallucinatory wish fulfillment, is also the source of defenses in the desire to avoid pain. Are you looking at me? That's time to stop. Enough?
I knew it would be effective.
Said enough?
No, we've got about 5 minutes. So.
Okay.
Don't rush.
Keep going. Okay. I'm used to being interrupted, so. Speech stops when it stops. And then it resumes once again when it does. So this is how, in Freud, jouissance appears in the symptom as a compromise formation between different psychical agencies. We're all familiar with that aspect of Freud's theory. There is the good of pleasure that represents pleasure for the id, but pain for the superego and the ego, and the pleasure of the good that represents pleasure for the superego and ego, but pain for the id. That's Freud. Pleasure and pain can acquire different meanings and significations within the imaginary and the symbolic, but in either case, what pleasure and pain have in common is a jouissance that comes from the real. Thus, the transformation of the symptom also involves a transformation of jouissance with respect to this question of pain and pleasure. Jouissance is not only a malevolent and deadly in a destructive way, as Lacan initially envisioned it, but it can also have benevolent aspects as seen in the third jouissance beyond the phallus. Because Lacan in the end manages to both place the phallus in a central position in the psyche, as Freud did, but at the same time, within the Borromean knot, incorporate another dimension beyond the phallus, where he places the third jouissance, feminine jouissance, beyond the phallus, jouissance of meaning, and the jouissance of the mystic. So what generates this transformation is something internal to the phallic function of castration. Okay? Lacan is the only one who still talks and develops this notion of the obscene notion of castration in Freud that everybody else tries to avoid as the plague itself. Thanks to symbolic castration, because castration is symbolic. That's the only way that we can make sense of it. And the nomination process associated with the name of the father and what he calls the capital phi, because he starts thinking of the function of the phallus in terms of mathematics, which is a place that Freud didn't go to. In terms of the capital phi and the small phi, which are irrational numbers in mathematics. So thanks to symbolic castration and the nomination process, as the changes in relationship to the name of the father, as a symbol of the father, the phallus becomes the signifier of a lack or the lack of a signifier. A signifier that points to a lack or where we find no signifiers for it. In Lacan's early work, the inconvenient jouissance is presented in two ways. As a deadly excitation that overcomes the protective barriers set up by the pleasure principle. As a surplus or excess jouissance. And as the malevolent fusion of the mother and the child. When the child occupies the place of the mother's imaginary phallus. Imaginary, stress on imaginary. The jouissance of the other, which is the jouissance, this fusion between mother and child, and the fantasy object that the child represents for the mother, is an inconvenient jouissance. that requires the intervention of the other. Because it is impossible to return to the fusion with the mothers, Freud well understood and theorized. The imaginary one, this fusion with the mother, is the other that does not exist, rather than the one that exists in the real. Now, there's a lot there. So this fusion with the mother that we all seek in some ways doesn't exist, because this other doesn't exist. And the first big other is the mother. But there is a one that exists. He puts a hyphen between X and cis, and you can put at quotation marks, as meaning something that exists outside the symbolic. So he says, il y a de l'un. There is something of the one, even though there is this imaginary fusion with the mother does not exist. There is no other of the other, because there is no ideal other, only greater or lesser approximations. The lack in the other as the real within the symbolic has to be left open and reconceived. In seminar 19, upir, or worst, meaning if you don't have the problem of having to deal with the father, then you have worse problems. Lacan speaks of the primacy of the one in the register of the real than the imaginary. The second jouissance that Lacan discusses in session 3 of seminar 23 is phallic jouissance. Lacan locates this jouissance between the symbolic and the real and links it to the parlettre, or the speaking being, and the signifier, but also to a parasitic form of power. Phallic jouissance is also a surplus or excessive jouissance, in that, like a foreign organism, threatens to destroy the psychic body with a preoccupation with the bad infinity of the phi as an irrational number. In phallic jouissance, there's always a calculation with the power of who has or does not have, who is or is not the phallus. That's the parasitic form of power. It's a kind of plague, psychic plague. Thus, the function of castration and of nomination of the capital phi as a name rather than as a number is required to put a stop to the parasitic bad infinity of the imaginary phallus. And he explains that in terms of mathematics, like with irrational numbers, like the golden number 0.168, 1.618. And so the decimals go to infinity. So at some point, to stop that infinite regression of numbers, you have to use the name and just call it phi. Punto. That's it. It's a phi. And you give up this attempt to calculate to infinity. That's why we're not machines, and that's why artificial intelligence will never quite get to the level, the human level of the symbolic. Because all the machine can do is just calculate to infinity. There has to be a third jouissance beyond the jouissance of the other and beyond phallic jouissance that would correspond to the new definition of the real that Lacan is advancing in seminar 23. So that third jouissance, Lacan says, using the example of feminine jouissance, he says, it's something that I experience, but I have no knowledge of. I know nothing of, although I experience it. And maybe left in silence. So I can say a few words about the proper name and nomination. Let me see what. How could I summarize this? The name as a process of nomination, as a name coming from the real, or the name as symptom, or the symptom as a name, is something else or new. The fourth is a third. So here Lacan is adding a fourth element, just one. That's all. Nothing more ambitious than that, to Freud's three. The real in the knot of three, here he's using knot theory and topology are two related branches of mathematics. The real in the knot of three is an imposition or a forcing of the imaginary and the symbolic into a knot or a torus that manifests an antagonistic relationship between the two registers of the imaginary and the symbolic, and then the real is also mistaken for one or the other. Either images supersede and hide the code that builds them, or words eliminate and deconstruct the realism provided by images. With the knot of four, each register can keep its independent contribution and at the same time be in a relationship of interdependency to each other. The real can remain unnameable and unknowable and at the same time be named and used for constructive purposes. Okay. Let me give you a more pedestrian notion of nomination, sort of to ground the theory further. Nomination, for example, is used to nominate or appoint someone to a political office, to an award like the Hollywood Oscars, or to the Nobel Prize. All of these are associated with the politics of knowledge, stardom, fame, and varied economic interests. Joyce, Freud, and Lacan were all concerned with fame and having their name linked to history and posterity. In this sense, nomination is very much associated not only with the name being used and circulated by the other, which is one of the ways that that Lacan thinks of nomination, is when a name starts circulating in through the other, through the generations, through culture, and becomes the common inheritance of a group. So Freud is our common inheritance, the destiny of a clan, and sometimes something clandestine. It's like when else in some ways is clandestine, it has to remain this clandestine position within the larger society in order to have this gap, leave the gap open, that they can be a new source of ideas and subjective transformations. In this sense, nomination is very much associated not only with the name being used by and circulated by the other, but also, perhaps more importantly, with the narcissism and ego ideal of the subject. Ego ideal, as we know in Freud's values, ideas, identifications. In the latter, it is this the latter which is accepted and considered inevitable by people of all sorts of persuasion, is what are inextricably involved with the imaginary phallus and the question of domination. The question of making all, and thus all the conflicts within the psychoanalytic societies, that we know, the plague that we have within psychoanalysis. The question of making a name for oneself can also be associated with the imaginary function of the name that serves as a stopgap for the lack in the subject. So it's this quality, this relationship to the name, and this narcissistic identificatory relationship to the name is what needs to be transformed in analysis, and this is what Lacan calls the process of nomination. And I think I'll stop there. I'm sorry for going so long.
No, that's absolutely fine. All right, Ronald, please join me on the stage. It's a bit cramped here. We just need to make sure that we don't fall off. Okay. Everyone's talking about the escabeau.
But if we fall off, we stand up again.
Right. I'll start us off with a pedestrian question. Your word, pedestrian. Unlike a few other people who have engaged with this particular seminar by Lacan, you've decided not to translate the word Lalong. John Forrester once, many years ago, translated television, and the text has disappeared into the archives because it was eventually published under someone else's name in translation. But he opted for, with Malera's approval, for Universal Babel, the translation of Lalong, with Malere's approval. I think Russell Grigg tends to translate it as Lalation. Adrian Price, I just double-checked, translates it in a way that is neither here nor there, by which I mean it's a translation, but it's not a translation. He translates it as La Lingua.
not La Lingua Franca, though.
No, just La Lingua, which, you know, I mean, either you translate or you don't, right? So, but you've decided not to translate it. And I do think that babbling, actually, with all due respect, of course, for John, is not a bad translation. So, just to start us off, could you just comment on why you've decided to keep the term? Mm-hmm. In all its French resonances, which of course add a bit of mystery to it, much like with Jouissance and Saint-Anne.
Well, thank you for the question. I think it was a more of an intuitive decision than a calculated one. So you're inviting me to reflect mm-hmm. on the intuition.
Mm-hmm.
I think one is that it has an homophony with language,
mm-hmm.
and yet being different. The babbling, I mean, babbling is sort of a despective term that makes it sound as if it didn't have a logic, whereas I think that La Langue does have a logic. It's a different logic, because when we talk of logic, it's not just a question of binary between logic or illogical. Because now we know that there are many different types of logic. So they function according to different types of logical organizations. So I think La Langue, the term La Langue has the possibility of thinking about it as a different type of organizing principle than simply just babbling away. Or not saying senseless things, but in the negative sense of senselessness. Right, because senselessness also can mean ridiculous, or it can mean, in fact, something very meaningful, but that's coming from a different dimension. So those would be my first response.
Lalation?
That has, I was just going to say, that has the lala.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, La La Land. You know. So it's a song quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little song, a little, you know, rhyme. So there's the aspect of that phonic aspect of sound in La Langue. And also it's a you could say the babbling of a child. But I think Anna Freud would take seriously the babbling
mm-hmm.
of a child.
Very much so.
Whereas in the pedestrian sense, you know, this is just, you know, just ridiculous. Like psychiatrists talking about the random firing of neurons. Just babbling away, just the brain doesn't know what to do with the excess of energy, so there are just these random firings that have no meaning and don't try to find any meaning in them. Just take the pill. So, yeah, but I would say those would be my three reasons for keeping the term in French.
Mm.
Maybe the fourth one, as a good symptom, would be just to in honor of Lacan.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I mean, the cover of the English edition of Seminar 23 has a picture of Joyce on it, and so does the French edition, by the way. So this is by no means the publisher's decision to appeal to the Anglophone readership. And there's a very good reason as to why Joyce appears on the cover of both the French and the English edition, is to say that, in a sense, the entire seminar was inspired by Lacan being invited to open what I think was the first international conference on Joyce in Paris during the summer before he started this seminar. And you see that throughout the academic year, Lacan takes Joyce by the hand, if not to say vice versa, Joyce takes Lacan by the hand. But he develops his ideas very much in a close engagement with not so much the life of James Joyce, but the text, the writing, of James Joyce. And because of that, this seminar has very much been regarded over the years as Lacan's psychoanalytic reading of Joyce. Now, one of the things I've actually appreciated in your book is that you've decided not to put Joyce center stage. And of course he does appear regularly, inevitably so. But you've decided to focus on what results, what comes out of Lacan's engagement with Joyce, opening it up into both a theoretical and a clinical discussion of the implications of these four terms for clinical practice. However, and that's my question, in another text that Lacan, if my memory serves me well, wrote in 1971 called Literatur, which is also, you know, Lacan's invention, so it's not, there's no such word in French called Literatur, right? So it's his play on littérature. But he says in this text that at one point Joyce was offered a psychoanalysis by his benefactor, Mrs. McCormick. And he says that with Jung, of all people, right? I think there's a good reason as to why Joyce was offered an analysis with Jung. It's partly to do with the fact that his benefactor was close to Jung and that they all lived in Switzerland at the time, right? But Lacan says, with Jung of all people. And then he goes on to say, and that's my question, he goes on to say, well, in his writing, and I don't know whether he had Ulysses in mind or Finnegan's Wake or indeed any other text by Joyce, but in his writing, Joyce went to the best one can expect from an analysis at its end. So he's basically saying, and it's not an argument, it's an assertion. You know, in good Lacanian fashion, you don't argue, you just state, right? And you leave mortals like us to do the work, you know, to reconstruct the argument. But he states, and it's always intrigued me, he states, look, in his writing, he went straight to the best one can expect from a psychoanalysis at its end. And the reason why I want to launch this with you, partly to see how you would interpret that, is also because you've alluded in your presentation about how the symptom becomes a symptôme, which of course in French also resonates with holy man, a symptôme is a holy man. In terms of the end of analysis, right? So the question is twofold, right? And we don't have to talk about Joyce if you don't want to, but what is it about Joyce's writing, the process and the outcome, that one can interpret as a process of moving towards the end of analysis? Mm-hmm. And what is it about the end of analysis that resonates with the act of writing and the materiality of the written text?
Okay. Well, thank you for the question. I think there's a question of method, because Lacan, in relationship to art and literature, he didn't believe in psychoanalysis doing biographical studies, because you can only get the true information, we can call it information, about the subject in analysis with the direct speech of the subject. So if you are kind of speculating and interpreting on the basis of a text or historical text or a biography or a history, we always know that all those histories are part fiction. So then you can't bypass that. Whereas in direct speech, in analysis, then something else appears there that truncates this attempt at fiction that you get in biographies only in relationship to a text. And then you can see that because what some pieces of biography that Lacan uses, if you go to the literature on Joyce, it's sort of partial sketches. Somebody else could say, yeah, but you said this about the father, Joyce's father, but then, you know, there's other stories about Joyce's father which seem to indicate the opposite of what you're saying. If you had an analysis in front of you, right, you would put these two things together. Well, you said this, and now you say this, which is how Lacan interprets interpretation, as a citation in the direction of an enigma, rather than an explanation, but always using the speech elements of the analysis. So that's one thing about method, where Lacan differs. So he's using the literary work and the biography to develop psychoanalytic theory. And in turn, students of literature can use psychoanalytic theory to develop their own theory that is applicable to that field, that specific field. So he didn't believe in applied analysis, only applied psychoanalysis to the clinic. How psychoanalysis is applied in the clinic, in different clinical formats, etc. Not just limited to the office and the couch, mm-hmm. which is consistent with how Freud practiced, mm-hmm. even though the IPA then disavowed that. Say, oh, that was just Freud's idiosyncrasies. So that's the first point. What were the other aspects? Remind me again.
Well, the question is really as to why.
The end of analysis.
Why
yes.
an act well, of writing?
Right. Well, I don't
and
know.
There's two aspects, right? So there's the act of writing.
Right.
And there is the production of, and then subsequently the publication, the release, the dissemination of the written text.
Right. So it's something in relationship to the transformation of how Joyce transformed his own relationship to his father through his work and through reappropriating his name in a different way. Mm-hmm. 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 And which then has an effect on how the name is circulated, because his father was a drunk, an Athenian, was partially successful in business, and Joyce had great aspirations for himself, but what it's not mentioned in the text is that so did Joyce's father. Joyce's father had much ambition placed on Joyce's intellectual abilities. So that's one aspect of how his writing transforms his own relationship to his name by him coming to be known as Joyce, which we know also means Freud in German's joy. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a commonality, Joyce, Freud, jouissance. Mm-hmm. Then also Freud said that, you know, that analysis often replicates things that happen normally in life also. It's not that psychoanalysis, although psychoanalysis seems to invent a new state of mind that wouldn't have existed without Freud. That's on the one side, on the one hand. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, psychoanalysis is doing something that life itself does. So, for example, with Freud we find the theory of sublimation. How sublimation is able to do to work with the defenses, with the id, and the superego, and transform the forces in both, or the opposite, reconcile somehow the conflict in the psyche through artistic pursuits, scientific pursuits, and so on. So in that sense, you could see how sublimation itself, the process of sublimation, whether it happens within analysis or outside analysis, seems to replicate something about the results of analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, that statement, that's why in my book, I find two different knots of four in Lacan's seminar when usually people just consider one. Because for me, it sort of leads to the paradoxical conclusion that only psychotic subjects can reach the logical end of analysis, which is a paradoxical statement because usually we consider psychosis to be incurable. So I think that leads to that problem leads to a contradiction. So in order to get out of that, use a paradox to guide our research, as is done in science, I thought it was necessary to come up with two knots of four, one for psychosis and one for neurosis. And the one for neurosis would actually indicate the best results that could be expected of analysis, because most analysis are of neurotics, despite how much interest there is about psychosis within psychoanalysis. But the majority of cases being treated in analysis, not the psychoanalysis, that's a whole other discussion, whether psychoanalysis is a valid, legitimate, efficient treatment for psychosis.
I'm going to ask you one more question about Joyce, and then, you know, time permitting, we can move on. I mean, from the very beginning of the seminar, Lacan introduces his audience to the complexity, the unreadability of Finnegan's Wake, which he designates as a book in which the author, i.e. James Joyce, has deconstructed the English language to the point where it no longer exists.
The end of English. The end of the new beginning.
Now, we can probably talk until we're blue in the face as to whether Lacan's interpretation is correct, but it goes without saying that anyone who picks up a copy of Finnegan's Wake rapidly comes to the conclusion that the text is particularly challenging, not only because Joyce writes in, I don't know, 60 different languages at the same time, but also because of the readability depends on the reader's own ability to move between writing, the written, and the signified. I mean, Joyce scholars have written endless papers as to how certain sentences in Finnegan's Wake only make sense if one actually reads them aloud, as a result of which you suddenly see the written text appear different qualities. Mm-hmm. Now, Lacan was trained as a psychiatrist, and during the 1930s had come across what he called back then inspired writings. That is to say, writings produced by psychotic patients, you say, as part of their delusion or as part of their road to recovery. But you know, in a sense, he knew something about the writings of psychotics. And maybe that's what at one point prompted him to launch the controversial hypothesis that Joyce was someone who had a psychotic structure. Now, I've always had problems with that, with that statement. And I don't care that the Lacanians have turned it into dogma. I've had problems with it because I don't think one can simply judge the psychotic structure, in this case, of the writer, or any kind of structure, if you want, of the writer, by merely looking at the style or the content of the writing. I think that slightly more sophisticated, complicated, and I don't claim I'm terribly sophisticated myself, but I think that one should at least also take into consideration the way in which the author, him or herself, relates to the process, to the act, and the written output. And in the case of Joyce, and I'm not sure this would apply to Schreber, but I think it applies to Joyce, I'd say that over a period of however long it took to produce Finnegan's Wake, right, 16 years, work in progress, I think he knew exactly what he was doing. I think he managed to distance himself, if you want, or to reflect upon the act of writing and the written product by giving readings, by talking about the process, like an artist would talk about the creative work that goes into the production of a work of art. And I'd say it's that distance, that critical distance, which I think he maintained, that at least for me would make me doubt that he really was within the throes of psychosis, or was trying to find a way to stabilize his own psychotic structure. And so I think that Lacan's point here, interesting as it may be, might in itself be a bit too rash, in as much as that he seems to be focusing almost exclusively on the fact that, well, only a psychotic could write 400 pages in 60 different languages at the same time. Right. You have to be psychotic in order to do that. I'm not sure. So I wonder what you think about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there isn't the same mechanism of the refusal of symbolization that you find in the construction of a completely parallel universe, where you have this complete separation between the pleasure principle and the reality principle. I don't think that that's true, that there isn't that kind of binary in Joyce. I actually don't think, if I had to bet on it, we can only bet on it, I wouldn't bet on the fact that Joyce had a psychotic structure. Nonetheless, what Lacan does with that is helpful for psychoanalysis and for the understanding mm-hmm. of psychosis and to how to differentiate psychosis from neurosis. Mm-hmm. So that goes with the method of using the work to develop psychoanalytic theory and practice, mm-hmm. irrespective of the fact whether that might be true or not, that Joyce was psychotic or not, because, you know, for that you have to meet with him. We have the letters of Joyce. And the letters of Joyce are not written like a psychotic would write a letter. If anything, it sounds a little bit more perverse, the love letters between him and Nora. Not perverse structure, but traits, perhaps. But he doesn't seem delusional whatsoever, where a psychotic subject engaging their love object would certainly become a lot more delusional. So there's some evidence there to that effect. Mm-hmm. But these are the limitations in terms of using psychoanalysis to read a text and to arrive at clinical conclusions from a text. Now, I think Schreber's cases, the memoirs, are quite different than Joyce. And certainly, Schreber didn't become it's not considered a masterpiece of 20th century or 19th century literature.
Well, it's not, but at the same time, my students prefer to read Schreber's memoirs than Joyce Finnegan's Wake. Because Schreber's memoirs, I'm not sure you've ever looked at them, they're actually quite coherent. The sentences, they're grammatical, the book is nicely structured, I mean, it doesn't take you too long before you come to the conclusion that the man must be a raving madman, but for different reasons than with Joyce, because he doesn't write in 60 different languages at the same time. I mean, Schreber writes in German, but you come to the conclusion that, he's a madman, probably for reasons that Zas would have appreciated. It's because you say, in all probability, this cannot have happened to him. Mm-hmm. So it must have been a figment of his delusion. That is to say, he must have been in the throes of a psychotic breakdown when he came up with this story. But I want to ask you one other thing that has, again, has been bugging me for a long time, and this is not a critique, because, you know, well, maybe it is, but I can criticize you a little bit, right? And you actually start the book by saying that, just a little bit, no, but actually you also start the book by saying that by no means is this a commentary that claims to unpack each and every corner of the seminar, and that comes up with the definitive reading of this text here.
Which would be a mistake.
And I agree with you. But I was really looking forward to your commentary on chapter 9 of the seminar, because in chapter 9, Lacan, for those of you who have read the seminar, you will probably remember this. Lacan, and it doesn't happen very often, he agrees to spend half of the session responding to questions, which have been submitted to him in advance. So he's had some time to think about it. But he says in response to a question, I do not think that psychoanalysis is a symptom. And this is not the word symptom, this is the word symptom. He says, I don't think psychoanalysis is a symptom. But I do think, I'm skipping a couple of paragraphs, I do think that the psychoanalyst cannot be conceived of otherwise than as a symptom. Given your, this is a bit of a contradiction in terms, given your knowledge of the symptom, or given your reading of the seminar, what do you make of this? I mean, is he saying that the only name that a psychoanalyst can carry, justifiably, if he or she wants to be accepted as the one directing the treatment, can be the name of the center? Mm-hmm. And if so, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And then we'll open it up to you.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, I had several responses flashing through my mind as I was hearing you speak, and then all of a sudden they're all gone. So that's the idea of, you know, we have to start from the place of not knowing, not in the sense of ignorance, but in the sense of doctrinal ignorance. In the Socratic, the true Socratic tradition, and I say, absolutely no idea. And then see what emerges. It's better to say, gee, I don't know, than trying to give a quick kind of knowledgeable response about something that could have many different sides, is not as certain and definitive as you would think, which is precisely the psychotic mechanism, is to just provide a certain kind of delusional interpretation of a phenomena. So I would suggest that that's the way to approach Joyce's text, and also the way to approach Lacan's text. Because I think for most people, maybe it's not that Lacan is not that much easier than Joyce. You know, you open Lacan, what is he talking, you know, about? And at first, ridiculous. Put it aside. Forget. We have so many more clearer and definitive explanations of what psychoanalysis is. Okay. But you see, then eventually, with time, the meaning starts to emerge. And this is what in Joyce we call an epiphany. Mm. So you wait, and it's part of like an analysis. You wait, you know, a long time until a person may say the same thing they said the first day that they came into analysis, but from a completely different place, with different associations, links to memories, and so on and so forth. And then it becomes a real experience. So, I think that's the aspect of incomprehensibility that I was talking about, that you need, he leaves an element of what he's talking about that is not completely comprehensible to, in time, we get to a place, now I understand what Lacan is talking about. It just took 20 years. So people say, no, don't wait 20 years. How can you wait 20 years, you know, to understand something? You know, nowadays you have PowerPoint, you know. You give the audience the PowerPoint. You have the point, and you point it with a laser or with a point. And, okay, the sentence is this. Can you read it there? Repeat after me, you know. There's nothing left unknown there. Because it's just a statement. There is no subject of enunciation. And for psychoanalysis, in speech, you need the subject of the enunciation, which precisely opens up this gap of the question of meaning and knowledge. What are you saying? So, I think
we can mull it over a bit more.
I didn't answer your question.
No, you didn't. But it's okay.
Say that again.
It's fine.
I'll say it in one sentence, standing up in one leg. Okay.
No, we'll open it up to the audience.
Okay.
It's okay. It's all right. We can take about 20 minutes. So.
Yes,
Jordan.
Oh, you call the question.
I call the questions here.
Okay. Yes.
You provide the answers, right? Jordan.
Thanks a lot for the talk. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the clinical vignette that you use, because I'm very confused about the difference between the symptom and the symptom. And I was wondering if you could be a bit more precise about what aspects, and maybe you could tell it, I don't know how much you can share, if this was an analysis, what sort of changed, what remained the same, what was transformed, what was the symptom and what was the symptom in that?
Okay, so let's talk about AA and NA, right? Which is kind of the most common form of treatment for addiction nowadays, since psychoanalysis somewhat, you know, it's not, doesn't treat addiction per se directly. And the general society decided that psychoanalysis did not work with addiction, and you can't wait for a long time for somebody to recover their unconscious knowledge in order for them to let go of the addiction, that doesn't happen. Right? But that's a big debate there. But so in NA or A, so hi, my name is Raul, and I'm an alcoholic. So the identity is right there in the symptom. And so you could say, well, precisely this person has a problem with addiction because of the short circuit in symbolic identifications. And because we have this decline, and I don't mean this to go back to a nostalgia for the old order of the father whatsoever. That's why Lacan clarifies the difference between the father in symbolic and the father in the real. There's no going back to the old, good old times of patriarchy. But we do observe the changes in relationship to the position of the father in society, for good or for bad. And so a link can be established between that and the problems with addiction. So NA and AA not only gives them an identity through the symptom, but creates a whole belief system that counters the addiction and that occupies the failure of symbolic identification. So that's the identification with the symptom. Whereas the identification with the symptom is something different, in that they can use the addiction and their inside knowledge of, you know, the street language that people use in drug use and in the life of criminality and rejection of of the law. That there was something useful that they could get out of that, that was something different than saying, hi, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic or I'm a heroin addict or whatever it may be.
I mean, it's very interesting how you put symptom and symptom in a logical sequence. How you don't just juxtapose them as two different sides of the clinical picture, but how you put them in an order whereby one can move, and I'm saying one, but maybe I should say a subject. A subject can move from one to the other as a result of the way in which psychoanalysis operates. And I mean, we don't have to labor the point, but I feel like saying that moving from one to the other no doubt also requires a certain modulation or modification of the jouissance that is attached to it, right?
Right.
Because it's not just about identity or identifications. It's about what a subject derives from those identifications in terms of jouissance that needs to be modified. Mm-hmm. And that may be actually the lever, if not the catalyst, to open up that space, right?
Yes.
Take some other questions. Steph?
Yeah, I suppose you partly clarified it a bit, but I was interested in what you said about the move from the name of the father in the symbolic to the name of the father in the wheel as being something that might happen through analysis, and then it struck me that it might also be linked to this move from the symptom in the name of the father to the santum in the wheel. So I was wondering if you could say some more about that, and also about, you hear about this sort of trajectory in Lacan where it starts from a very kind of absolute name of the father, and then you've got this pluralization of the name of the father. And I guess, long story short, the question is, by the time we get to the Santum, where does that really leave us in terms of differential diagnosis? And does the prognosis for neurosis change that dramatically?
Did you want to say something?
No.
I was hoping you would.
You're up.
Okay. In terms of diagnosis, I don't think it's a diagnostic question. It's an analytical question, but it's not a diagnostic question. Analysis involves a changing relationship to the name, to the person's own name. And of course, you know, we know that Lacan took that from Freud, in terms of playing with combinations and transformations that take place in relationship to a name, how the unconscious manifests or evolves out of that. Sometimes, so Lacan says in the end, the subject would come up with a new name or a new relationship to their name. Often you find out that people, you know, after talking to some time, they either have a total devaluation or rejection of their name because it feels like an imposition. So this is the imposition of language in the symbolic order that Freud promised to help individuals with. Here I create this space where you can come and I will help you unburden yourself from the impositions of the culture. And so the imposition of the name is part of that because the name comes from the other. So you either have to come to terms with that, whether you love or hate your name, and all the stories that you will hear surrounding the names, how the parents chose the name, and so on and so forth. And the question, or the narcissistic investment of the name, that would be another thing. So both edges, you know, are going to be kind of refined, where the idealization, the devaluation of the name, because Lacan says the name has to become a common noun, an ordinary thing. And then out of that ordinary thing, something new will be revealed for the subject. So Sometimes it may be, you know, I decided that I like my second name better than my first name. And people love nowadays as part of the culture to change their name. I see a lot of people, young people in analysis, who totally reject the name as patriarchal imposition, you know. And so they just, you know, just call me Floating Cloud, you know. Because I'm a floating cloud. I'm not going to be pinned down by my father with the name that he gave. I hate him. Hate his guts. Right? But then, when they have kids, then they face the dilemma of, well, why don't you ask the infant, what do you want to be called? Blah, 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 blah.
But you know what, Raoul? It made me realize something. And it's interesting how in conversation, you know, epiphanies happen.
Yes.
So you don't have to wait and sit there for them to happen. You can just have a conversation with someone for them to happen. But when I asked you earlier on about Lacan's assertion that the psychoanalyst can only be a Saint-Homme, I didn't have the answer to my own question. I really didn't. But in listening to you, it got me to realize that what you're trying to explain does not just relate to first names or surnames or any names that allow us to situate ourselves within a certain genealogy or a kinship. It refers, in a sense, to any kind of name that can provide us with an identity. I think it refers to any kind of name with which we can identify. And that includes, crucially, also the name psychoanalyst. Because we all know that for quite a few people who are in psychoanalysis or who think about psychoanalysis, that very name comes with status, with identity, with recognition, social recognition and other recognition. And I think what Lacan, and I didn't know that until you started talking, is trying to get at here is that the very name psychoanalyst can become a symptom in its own right, and it's only when that symptom is stripped of it, the jouissance that it brings, that a psychoanalyst is worthy of being justifiably identified as a psychoanalyst. And he doesn't unpack it, but I think what he's trying to get at is how the very process of psycholytic training needs to involve a desymptomatization of the name psychoanalyst in favor of its crystallization as a name that is devoid of jouissance that is associated with it. Because otherwise, you train a psychoanalyst who enjoys being a psychoanalyst. And that can never be justifiably acceptable, I would say. Right? But anyway, I'll carry on.
I'd like to read that paper. The one you're going to write about that.
I'm not writing a paper, I'm just ranting. Okay, I'll take another couple of questions.
Hi. You said that in the knot of three, the
yes.
real is mistaken as either the imaginary or the symbolic, but
right.
in the one with four,
yes.
that there's an interdependency. So that would insinuate that the real influences the imaginary and the symbolic just as the imaginary and symbolic influence the real. So that's kind of like the first part. And then I was like relating that back to, tell me if I'm wrong, this kind of like jouissance beyond the phallus and this like feminine
jouissance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you kind of talk about how the real and the interdependency of the real influencing the imaginary and symbolic occurs in this jouissance beyond the phallus?
Right. Okay. So at first the imaginary supplants the real. So, and that also goes with the way that Lacan first spoke about the real as something very disturbing and disorganizing for the symbolic. And in the end, the real is the actual gap. It's sort of like a black hole that structures a constellation of planets, rather than being something. It can eat them. So that, you know, in physics, they say, well, sometimes you misunderstand that that a galaxy is being eaten by an active, voracious, hungry black hole. But in fact, the black hole, that's only for the ones that get very close to the event horizon. But other than that, the black hole is actually structuring the galaxy and putting the planets and celestial bodies into their orbit. So the real is a structuring gap for the symbolic, as opposed to being something that is going to threaten the coherence of the symbolic, like the real in psychosis, for example. So that's a different definition of the real in the early Lacan and the late Lacan. And he explains that in this seminar, how the imaginary has this consistency like the real, so the consistency of the imaginary is mistaken for the consistency of the real, which actually involves the entire knot. And that, in normal experience, that's also reflected in how the predominance of visual perception, how we take visual perception as the paradigm for what reality is. And we don't see how what we call the images of the world are stuffed with the signifier, but we wouldn't recognize it. So it's like you have in a computer, you have the images that you perceive in virtual reality, but they're all made by a code of letters or numbers or combinations of letters and numbers which generate the images in the visual field. So we also have that element of trickery or deception, not just in fantasy, but in actual, a normal distortion of vision. So the real in the later Lacan has a constructive function. So with the fourth element, then the real can, through this process of nomination, can acquire its constructive function, rather than it being something that is forcing this dichotomy between the imaginary and the symbolic. There's a great movie, I don't remember that, I think it's called Words and Images, about two professors in a university college. And one, the whole movie is about how they have a debate about whether words are more important or whether images are more important. And then the drama is played out in their personal relationship. So that's the problem with how the real forces these two circles within a knot to create this knot of three that has all this kind of tensions built into it, so that in analysis we have to deconstruct that. So the rings have to become undone, and that's part of what he says there, that in order for healing, actually, the registers have to be undone. In psychosis, they're partially undone because the imaginary is loose from the real and symbolic. They have language, they can speak. But it's mostly a kind of imaginary interpretation of language. So the healing of neurosis actually requires a more radical deconstruction that a neurotic can do, because the links between neurons and between words and images has not been broken. Because it is unbroken, then that you can risk the deconstruction without triggering a psychosis. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's important at the beginning to make a good assessment of whether you're dealing with a psychotic structure or a neurotic structure, to see what can be done in the analysis and what cannot be done. Does that answer your question? Push further if you want.
Kind of. I mean, you didn't comment on kind of this, the aspect of the feminine.
Okay. So, for example, the feminine is the difference between the imaginary and the real, because the feminine jouissance is in the real. Like, there's a dimension of femininity that's in the real, but it's not that real femininity can be mistaken for this fusion identification with the mother,
which you said doesn't exist.
Which doesn't exist, and it's a false kind of femininity, because ultimately it comes down to the question of phi and minus phi. Who has it? Who doesn't have it? Who is it? Who's not it? So, feminine jouissance, even though it's beyond the phallus, still requires the intervention of the paternal function in order to get there. But once you get there, then you're in a place beyond it, if that makes any sense. And the other aspect of the femininity, of feminine jouissance, is that it's a floor within femininity. So that's why the formulas of sexuation, Lacan says, all women are subject to castration, like men are, but there's a dimension of femininity that's not all under the phallus, or all under patriarchy, or the symbolic function, or however you want to think about that. But that's a singular case by case. It's not a whole movement. It's not a feminist movement, because it doesn't come through the universal, and it doesn't come through the particular. It comes through the logic of singularity. And that's a logical development in Lacan, where he's trying to be, basically we're still stuck with Aristotelian logic of the universal and the particular, because Aristotle was so successful sociologically that that's all what we have in science. It comes down to that logic, but the Socrates and the pre-Socratics had this dimension of singularity that's not there in the square of oppositions. And that's, Lacan is following mathematicians like Frege, you know, who criticized Aristotelian logic. So femininity precisely responds to this logical of one by one of singularity. And that's where you find the feminine that's beyond the phallic function.
I'll take one more question. Was there someone else? Okay.
Well, I'd actually...
If you can be succinct, and if Raoul can be even succincter, yes. Then we might squeeze in another one.
I'm insisting on the first bit of his question that I think was brilliant. Like, if you could talk a little bit more about, if we could phrase it like that, the metonymic slide between the father from the symbolic to the real, because I think something you said that is very interesting. We would like to listen a bit more about it.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that precisely this question of the symptom, of the third jouissance, of femininity and all that, we're at the limit there of the possible, or we're actually facing the impossible. So you say, can you explain that further? And no matter what you say about it, eventually it's not going to hit the mark, because precisely we're dealing with the impossible. So there is no universal definition of it. So I can give, you know, this answer here, this answer over there, which is according to the singular situation, just like it happens in analysis. So it's hard to say what it's that going to look like for each, universalize it. Every analysis should do this way. And this is going to be the outcome. It's going to be different for each one. So that's why what I was trying to say about that is, in the case of Joyce, how Joyce reappropriated the kind of use that he made of his name. Sometimes they may come up with a different name, but it's going to be something different than, you know, call me Floating Cloud, because that's just involves just this kind of rejection of the name of the father, a kind of disavowal of it, which is part of the perhaps the trait, not the structure, but the trait of perversion in the culture, where there's this kind of disavowal of inheritance, of genealogy, of history, and so on and so forth. And you don't recognize that when you get rid of all those things, the structure is still there and reproduces itself. So we have a new name, but it's still the master's discourse. So this emergence of something different in the real is part of the analytical discourse, and precisely is with the analyst occupying, I call the position of the analyst, the master of none, rather than the master of one. If the analyst is a master of one, the analyst is a symptom. In order for the analyst not to become a symptom, the analyst has to remove, first use that, oh, you think I'm the master of one. Not exactly those words. Use that to develop the transference, but then eventually the analyst has to remove himself or herself from that position in order to allow. So there's something in the subjectivity of the analyst that facilitates a transformation in the subjectivity of the analyst. So that's a partial answer to your question, too.
I'll take one more. I can't remember now who, I think you had your hand up, no? Yeah? Did you not?
Well, it was more in relation to psychosis, because we haven't mentioned much about it, and I was just interested in this transformation between the symptom and the symptom, and I like the kind of wordplay you made, from one to the other, but I'm wondering if it's more about, like, if it's from one to the other, or another, or beyond the other, or there's simply no other, and you just have to create something like out of nothing. I'm just wondering, because you mentioned that in this knot of four, there would be a different one from neurosis and one from psychosis. And you got stuck there.
What were you going to say? You want to end here? You want to cut?
No, I was going to say, I don't want to speak for you, Raoul, but you obviously interpreted it as me being very keen to come up with an answer. I mean, look, my very quick response would be that, strictly speaking, from a Freudian perspective, there is no such thing as a symptom in psychosis. Because for there to be a symptom, there needs to be repression. And if you work with a structure that does not include, that's the right word, that does not derive its raison d'etre from repression, then that means that whatever appears is, strictly speaking, not symptomatic. And that's why Lacan in Seminar 3 actually, for all I know, doesn't talk about the psychotic symptom. He talks about elementary phenomena, he talks about, well, phenomena in general, but not about the symptom. Which means that the process of transformation that we were talking about earlier on, from symptom to symptom, strictly speaking, also can't take place. Because you don't have a symptom to be transformed. Which implies, further down the line, that the symptom, as a form of bricolage, as a form of tinkering with one's problematic state of mind, would have to be, and I think it's Lacan's words rather than mine, created. And this is, again, something we haven't talked about. So it's not by accident, in a sense, that Lacan, both here and elsewhere, talks about the creative aspect of psychoanalysis. And I think it's particularly apposite with reference to psychosis, precisely because there isn't a symptom to start with in the first place. But that's, I mean, it's. I don't think it's as original as it sounds, because already Freud, in his reading of Schreber, came to the conclusion that in the act of writing and in Schreber going through the process of putting pen to paper and giving shape to his delusion, something was being created that had a stabilizing function. I mean, he talks about the delusional labor. Freud talks about how the delusion is not just something in Schreber that should be looked at as a pathognomonic sign of someone being in the throes of psychosis, but as something that is already on the way to healing. Which is probably just about the most controversial point of his whole analysis of Schreber. I mean, we're not talking about homosexuality or anything, but so Freud articulates that the delusional labor is a creative process that has a stabilizing function. Of course, Schreber didn't have an analyst, right? So let's not forget that somehow he managed to find the energy, I think I was saying the courage within himself to do it, but I think he found it at the point where he thought, but I don't know how he thought it, I need to get out of here. Because let's not forget that he wrote the memoirs with one purpose, and the purpose was to convince the psychiatrists that he was well enough in order to be released. Right? But so what you say, I think, is exactly to the point, with the caveat that the whole concept of symptom becomes very problematic in psychosis, because, you know, there's no repression. Right?
The only thing, I agree with everything you said, the only thing I wouldn't agree with is the premise.
The premise.
Because I think it's a...
Hang on, if you don't agree with the premise, how can you agree with everything else?
Because I'm delusional.
Then we'll stop.
I think with the invention of the real unconscious, one of the aspects of it in Lacan, is that it's not that in psychosis there's no defense, there's no repression, but there is defense. That's why he came up with the idea of foreclosure. So in neurosis... First of all, the psychic structure is created through primary repression. Freud never came up with an answer to what's the nature of the repressive force, other than saying it's an unconscious ego, which is not a very strong formulation. Lacan gives a response that it's actually the name of the father that is behind the primary repression and why we have so much ambivalence and hatred. Because it involves imposing this kind of structure on the psyche that creates the neurosis. So even though there's no primary repression, there is the defense of foreclosure.
Sure.
So in neurosis, the unconscious is created through repression. In psychosis, the unconscious is created through foreclosure. And it's the foreclosure that I would say creates a symptom in psychosis. As Lacan says, instead of something being repressed, that is repressed within, it's foreclosed, thrown out of the symbolic order, and comes back in a hallucinatory fashion from the real that the psychotic mistakes for reality. And that's I would argue that's a construction of a symptom.
Well, I would argue against, but anyway, we're not going
to
do it tonight.
I would love
maybe
to
on another
occasion.
Raoul, thank you so much for writing the book, for your presentation, and for agreeing to enter a conversation with me, and indeed for entering a conversation with the audience. So, great to have you. Thank you.